We have spoken about mindfulness of the body and mindfulness of content of thought. Body first foundation of mindfulness, content of thought fourth foundation of mindfulness. And I mentioned the four great efforts, which mean not to keep unwholesome thoughts, but change them into wholesome ones. And with that we discuss the hindrances, which are all unwholesome, and all of them having an opposite that we can use in order to substitute and to learn to drop. The main thing with that is that through the meditative practice, we learn not to believe what we're thinking if it's unwholesome. Practically, everybody believes what they're thinking because they're thinking it. That's not a good enough reason to believe it just because one is thinking it. Now, a meditator must find that out within the first moments, actually, or first weeks of meditation, that there's no need to believe anything that the mind is throwing up, because actually one wants to meditate and the mind is thinking, and it's thinking all sorts of things which can make one unhappy. Why one should believe that is a myth. It's absurd, and everybody does it. So in order to change one's mind, which we're doing all the time anyway, but in order to change it to the point where we're able to either drop or substitute or use intermediate step of thinking of something entirely different, it's necessary that we don't believe that, what the mind is throwing up. Now, when we need to make a living or decide which way to go in the car or make a decision what to buy, well, we'll have to make a decision and do it. But we don't have to believe, and these are neutral decisions. They're neither wholesome nor unwholesome. They're just in order to keep alive. But if we continue to believe the thoughts which are negative, which are, as they are called in the Buddhist terminology, unwholesome, if we continue to believe our fears, our rejections, our worries, if we believe them, we can't change them. So a meditator who has been labeling and has learned to label the thoughts that arise must know within a very, very short period of time that all that arises just arises and ceases again and can be changed. It doesn't have to stay that way. And so we change it in the meditation into attention on the breath, or on the prevailing meditation subject, and in daily life we change it to something wholesome. If we don't get that first point, that we don't believe our own thinking anymore, we won't get to the second one, to substitute, to change. So it's very important that we investigate this. One of the things that one can easily see is that I am the only one that's thinking like that amongst 5 or 6 billion people. So how can that be true? Is it really possible that I've got the right slant on it and nobody else does? Very unlikely, isn't it? And if I were to say my thoughts to a person who is with me, so having the same situation and maybe even the same family or the same interests, one can be quite sure that person isn't thinking the same thing. It's very rare that another person should think even along the same lines that one is thinking, never mind the same thing. So maybe that will help to recognize the fact that it's absurd to believe negative thinking. Which has nothing to do with the fact that there's a lot of things in the world which aren't the way they should be. Why is that? Because there's a lot of things within us that aren't the way they should be. The macrocosm and the microcosm, they relate to each other in complete connection. So why believe anything that would make one unhappy? And on top of it would make not only oneself unhappy, but probably one's surroundings also, the people around one. It's if we don't catch that within us, that we stop believing what we're thinking, we haven't got a handle on the spiritual path. As long as we believe everything that we're thinking, we are in a trap. Most people are. They believe what they're thinking, and some people handle that in a way which is also not useful. I've mentioned it yesterday, but I'd like to mention it again because it is not as rare as one might think. They're quite aware of the fact that unwholesome thinking gives them a feeling of unhappiness. So instead of being aware of what's really happening, they're trying to make out everything is wonderful. But it isn't. It just is. It's neither terrible nor wonderful. It is. And if one can't see the reality of the way things are, one can't come to real insight. So even when one thinks everything is just wonderful, that too doesn't have to be believed. It's very rarely that something is wonderful. An enlightened one is wonderful. The experience of jhana, while it's lasting, is wonderful. The feeling of love within oneself is wonderful. And I think with that we have exhausted the wonderful things. The rest just are. That's it. And it's a big mistake to try to eliminate negativity through the imagination of the utopia. So it's just as big a mistake. It's the other extreme. Extreme on one side is things aren't the way they ought to be, well, true, or everything is just marvelous. Both are extremes, and neither one will give us an insight. But what will give us an insight is that thoughts are just arise and cease, and that we don't have to live with thoughts ever that bring unhappiness. One happy person creates happiness in the world. But not because that happy person now thinks everything is just fantastic, but because there is inner joy, independent of outer experience. And for that we need the understanding that what we think, it's not necessarily so. And if it isn't happiness producing, we can change it. Now, that we can't always change it immediately, and that we cannot always catch it in time, that's a second matter, which is quite true. But at least we should know that it's possible, and that it's just a matter of practice to do it. the... The second foundation of mindfulness are feelings. In Pali, Vedana Nupasana. And we have an array of possibilities there of what to become mindful of. The most important aspect of it are our emotions. Feelings do entail a physical sensation and emotion, the two. But with the physical sensation, we react with an emotion. So as we have them, the emotion becomes most important. So as we have talked about the way to substitute and change and let go with thoughts, we have the same with our emotions. And there we have something which is very important and can't be said and thought about often enough. We have the four emotions, which are the only ones, the Buddha said, worth having. In Pali, they are the Brahma Viharas. Now, a vihara is an abode, a place to live. Our new forest monastery in Germany is called Metta Vihara, a place to live with metta, or to learn metta, or to have metta, or whatever. A vihara is not necessarily a monastery. A vihara is a place to live. And Brahmas are the gods, the highest four realms of the 31 realms of existence. So the Brahma Viharas are very often translated as divine abodes. We don't need to think that in order to practice or perfect these four emotions, we have to become godlike. Or we have to get rid of this existence as a human being and have another existence. Nothing of the sort. What it actually means is that when we do practice those four and get them to the point where they are the most noticeable within us, we are actually creating paradise within, the divine abode within. We can live within ourselves in a way which is secure, which is equanimous, peaceful, happiness producing for ourselves and others, and comes to the point at one stage, when we've practiced long enough, where these emotions are no longer dependent upon outer circumstances. Now, those of you who've been in my courses know what they are. In Pali, metta, karuna, mudita, upekkha, loving kindness, compassion, joy with others, and equanimity. Again, they are four headings which encompass all our wholesome, positive, helpful, loving emotions. For instance, the emotion of being helpful, of giving, also would fall under loving kindness. The Buddha very often did this in many, many instances, just like I said that the five hindrances have derivatives. They have, they are like headings for our difficulties. The same is with the Brahma-viharas. The same is with these four supreme emotions. They all have derivatives. And which is a good thing, because when we hear that we should love everybody, the mind immediately replies, well, that's a bit much. In fact, there was a very funny picture postcard I got sent one time. There's a sort of a figure, well, looked like a Mickey Mouse or something. And this Mickey Mouse was saying, I love everybody. And to the right, a monster appeared. And it said, I am everybody. So this is another warning, which also happens to people that don't investigate themselves very well. It's wishful thinking. I love everybody equally well. It's great. It's an ideal. It's the goal, but it's not the reality. It's what we need to learn, but it's not what's happening now. And we should be satisfied with the fact when we recognize that we don't love everybody equally, because then we can do something about it. If we don't recognize it, if we think that we love everybody, and there are any number of people who think that, the person they love least is usually themselves, people who think like that, then they haven't got any way to practice. They think they love everybody equally. But when we realize we don't, we've got something to do. So we should be happy to find out. Love is a word which is loaded with all sorts of meanings in all languages. Of course, in English just as much as in any other language. And it seems to mean something specific to each person, and there are some general specifics that we believe love to be. We believe love to be this relationship from one person to another, and we believe love to be the love of a mother for children, and very often the mother expects the children to love her back the same way. And we also believe that love has to have a recipient, and we also believe that love can only be extended to that which is lovable. Then we also believe that love has to be reciprocal. We also believe that the other person, whoever it is that we love, must want to be loved, and that we can only love if there is a specific person around to love. That last one is the greatest absurdity and the most cause for unhappiness. Again, we have 6 billion people, and if we need one of those in order to be able to love, we're limiting ourselves to such a degree that we never find out what love really means. None of that, what I've just enumerated, means love. None of it means metta, loving kindness. It hasn't got even a resemblance to it. It's usually self-perpetuating. It's ego-centered, because if I love, I want to get something back for it. And there's got to be something there, someone or something. Which is also one of the reasons when religion and why religion doesn't work. If I've made up my mind I'm going to love God, I want to get something out of that. At least grace. Doesn't work. has never worked and never will. Love is a quality of the heart which actually can be learned, which is a very, very favorable situation, because if we couldn't learn it, we'd be stuck with this idea that it is a matter of chance. It's a matter of luck or chance that we meet somebody who's willing to love us, and so we can love them back, or vice versa. It's all very nice if somebody else loves us, because it supports our ego illusion in the best possible way, because we can tell ourselves, I'm really lovable. That person loves me. Even if it's only one amongst 6 billion. Should that person change his or her mind and things fall apart, as they're apt to do after some time, then, not always, but very often, then all of a sudden the idea enters the mind, I'm not lovable. And so the ego is crushed and we're facing a tragedy, because that one person has changed his or her mind. And we have forgotten that changing one's mind is a natural phenomena. Just like everything else changes, so the mind changes constantly. So we're facing a tragedy which usually takes you 2 years to get over, and then we start all over again. And we do that 4, 5, 6, 7 times. Some people find out after 4 times that it doesn't work. Some people never find out. They keep on going. And this idea of love is nothing but a way to relate to one other person. And it creates enormous dependence. Being dependent on the emotions of another. Well, that's exactly the opposite of what the Buddha taught. He taught freedom, and freedom is independence. You've got to be independent in order to be free. So, this kind of relationship, while it may be very useful, and certainly has, in the social context, an enormous use, can be considered to be a seedbed. It can be considered to be a starting point where we can learn what it means to be very careful of other people's feelings, where we can learn to be less egocentric, where we can learn to comply with somebody else's wishes. And all these things are very useful. And we can also learn what it feels like to have a warm and caring feeling. But we can never learn in these relationships what it means to have a pure loving feeling which is totally independent of the fact of another, whether another person is actually there. With this kind of relationship, love, what we have is we are adamant that the other person has to be there. And because of that, there's fear. And fear is equal to hate. It's one of the derivatives of hate. Doesn't mean we hate the other person. We hate the idea of loss. And since everybody knows that everything is impermanent, the idea of loss is always present. Mothers with small children are particularly prone to that fear. And while they love their kids dearly, they are constantly in a stew and in an uproar that these kids should never, nothing should happen to them. It takes years and years of practice to be able to let go of that fear. It's the only way to do that is to work on the contemplation of one's own death and the death of one's loved ones, which we have already done here. This is one of the strongest fear symptoms, which are confused with love. Real love has nothing to do with fear. Nothing at all. Real love is embracing, caring, togetherness, warmth, and the giving of oneself. Now, the togetherness doesn't have to be physical. Not at all. I'm sure you can now love a person who's not present. There's no need for physical togetherness. What love really entails is learning to let go of hate. It's as we let go of our negative reactions, as we learn to let go of that, what we dislike, we have more chance of loving that which is around. Now, love can be for people, for nature, and for an ideal. These are the three kinds of love that we are mostly concerned with. The most trouble we have with loving people. And why do we have so much trouble with loving people? Mainly because we don't love ourselves. We know all the difficulties that are harbored in our heart and mind, and we judge them and criticize them. And we don't love ourselves in spite of them and with them, but we sort of make a division. We love that part of us which is nice, and we don't love that part of us which we consider not nice. So we've got a half and half love. And we do exactly the same with everybody else. Well, that cannot bring purity of heart. The Buddha's teaching, the path, is the path of purification. The most extensive commentary on the Buddha's teaching is the Visuddhi Magga. Magga, path, and Visuddhi is purification. It was written in the 5th century by a monk called Buddhaghosa, and it is the most exact and explicit commentary on everything the Buddha said. And the Buddha's path is the path of purification, because only when there is purification in heart and mind, can we actually experience and recognize things in a totally different way. As long as this purification hasn't happened, hate and greed are overpowering. Doesn't mean that we hate people very strongly or somebody. It doesn't mean that we have to have things all the time. It just means that we are concerned with wanting and getting rid of. It brings a great deal of anxiety, it brings restlessness, we have already discussed that. But it also prohibits the loving heart. Now, if we look at ourselves in this half and half fashion, there's a nice part of me, and I can actually have a good feeling about that. And there's a not nice part of me, and I have no good feeling at all about that. I have to criticize it and judge it. That's not love. Not at all. Loving oneself doesn't mean that we now, from then moment when we've learned to love ourselves, no longer recognize the things that we need to change. The two have nothing in common. The formula is recognition no blame, change. We can recognize in ourselves, we can recognize in others, difficulties, hindrances, obstacles. Everything is there to be recognized, but nothing is there to be disliked. We usually say to that, we don't love the crime, but that's no reason why we shouldn't love the criminal. Now, obviously, we don't meet so many criminals, but in our eyes, and with the way we actually confront people, they might as well be, because we have constant judgments and ideas how they ought to be, which are strictly our own ideas. And as I said before, there's no point in believing our own thoughts, none whatsoever, unless we have found the way of true inner joy and happiness, independent of anything else. And then we won't think those thoughts, because they don't make anybody happy. We confront ourselves and we confront others as if we had been called upon to be judge and jury. And to be judge and jury, first of all, we don't even have the necessary qualifications. And secondly, it's not a very pleasant way to be. And yet everybody does it and believes it. And because we believe it, we are stymied as far as love is concerned. What we can do and what we need to do is to use our everyday life, all the confrontations we have with other people, to recognize the fact whether there's actually love in our hearts or not. The Buddha gave a simile or an analogy for love, which is very useful for people who have children. He said that one loves everybody just as a mother loves her own child. So we have a sort of criteria. If we have had a good relationship with our own mother, we can turn that around and say the criteria is to love everybody just the way our mother loves us. If we have children, we can see within the first minute of looking that that particular child is a totally different, has a totally different reaction from us as far as love and care and concern is concerned than anybody else. The difference is tremendous. In fact, it is so enormous that one can't even bring the two together. Now there we have something that we can at least use as a model, or using one's own mother. If we don't have anything like that as a model, we need to use the person who we most love as a criteria or a model. The feelings we have for that one person, but not those of which also arise, of course, when we have this strong relationship, jealousy, judgment, the kind of criticizing that we do, the half and half affair, nothing like that. We need to use that feeling, which is actual love and purity of love, and then see how much of that can we extend to anybody, to whoever comes into our orbit of meeting them. And we will find that very little of that arises. It's natural if one hasn't worked on it. One has an interest in people from whom one can get something. Now, it may be that one gets from them some support. It may be that one can get some interesting new knowledge. It may be that one gets physical help. One has an interest in them. Why? Because it's, again, ego-centered. What am I getting out of it? And we forget completely that if we actually educate our heart to be loving, that's the most we ever get out of anything. There's nothing to be compared with that. We don't have to look for anybody to love us, because anybody who loves us is just an ego support. It's their love, it's not ours. We don't even have to look for anybody whom we can love. If we are able to learn this impersonal and unconditional love, then we have that within us which gives us the greatest security, gives us a feeling of ease and a feeling of inner warmth, a feeling of peacefulness. And why is that? Because we know that we're going to react to whatever happens once we have made it fairly strong within. We're going to react to whatever happens, not with anger, not with hate, not with dislike, but with lovingness. And that gives self-confidence, clarity, ease, feeling of well-being, inner well-being. And it removes and eliminates all the negative happenings which happen in the mind and heart. Nobody always gets what they want. We always get something that we don't want. Even the Buddha got things he didn't want. It's strictly our reaction to that which makes it either just a happening or some sort of tragedy or some sort of unfavorable situation. If we don't react like that, nothing like that will ever arise. And what we usually do, if somebody makes something happen that we don't want, we start disliking that person. There's no need for that. We start disliking that person immediately. There is this inner turmoil. And we all either want to change the person, or we want to change our situation, or we want to find something, some outer change. Don't like what's going on. Well, I'm sure that all of us have made a lot of outer changes in this life. Some of them may have been quite valuable, but none of them will have produced inner happiness and inner peace independent of outer situations. That can only happen within us. And that can only happen if we learn to love. And learning to love does not mean that we then have these rose-tinted glasses on, that everybody is wonderful. Frankly speaking, nobody is wonderful. Just that Arahant is wonderful. And there are so few of them around, we don't even have to discuss that. Everybody is. That's more like it. And since we have the ability to love, why in heaven's name don't we use it? It's a cause for great inner joy, the cause for great inner security. And we do have other abilities. We have the ability to criticize, to dislike, to be fearful, to worry. We have all those abilities. We use them constantly. That's rather foolish, isn't it? We use all those abilities and we actually perfect them. We're very good at them. Instead of using the ability to love, which we could just as well perfect and become very good at. One of the things which happens when we try to do that, and obviously if you have heard me often enough and heard about the Buddha's teaching often enough, one will try. Not always with immediate success. But one of the things that happens is that one also creates a fair bit of compassion in one's heart for oneself. Because one sees quite clearly the detrimental effects of self-criticism, self-judgment, and this half-and-half love that I talked about. And then, if one can feel compassion for this person that could just as well have learned to love properly, it's not so difficult to feel that same compassion for others. It's a little easier to be compassionate than to be loving. To be compassionate does not mean that one pities oneself or others. The far enemy of compassion is cruelty, which is quite easy to see, but the near enemy is pity. Pity is separating oneself, being an observer that is still criticizing. When we look at somebody else and we see, oh, look at that person, aren't they having an awful time? We don't have empathy. We don't have that with feeling. We just feel very sorry that the other person is having a terrible time. And underneath all that, it's very likely that we also think, maybe without verbalizing, boy, am I glad it's not me. That's not compassion. Com is with. And passion is a strong feeling, a strong with feeling. It's empathy. It only arises if we've seen our own difficulties without criticizing them, just recognizing them. It takes a clear mind to do that. It takes a mind that's interested in truth, in truth on all levels. It takes a mind that is willing to be truthful about itself without any exaggerations one way or another, and without any blame. Once we have seen ourselves as we really are, it's not easy to be a human being. And it's even more difficult to be a good human being. If we can see ourselves like that, with all the details maybe which we can get hold of, we can see everybody else like that. And then, when we have that with feeling, they're the same as me. They're also looking for inner happiness and inner peace. They haven't found it. and they're also trying to love, and quite often they're not.